From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Clashes erupted after thousands took to the streets of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, Wednesday, denouncing the country's preliminary presidential election results. Exit polls on election day showed that 6% of voters said they voted for government-backed candidate Jovenel Moïse, placing him fourth in a field of 54 candidates. But preliminary official results announced November 5th claimed that Moïse polled first with nearly 33% of the vote, placing him in a runoff with second place Jude Celestine, who reportedly polled just over 25%. A poll by the Brazil-based Igarapé Institute found deep public suspicion of the election results, with more than 90% of those polled saying they disagreed with the statement, quote, "As far as I can see, this election is fair. There is no fraud," closed quote. Haiti's National Electoral Council has not released final results and has thus far rejected calls by opposition leaders for a recount. A runoff election is scheduled for December 27th and is expected to feature Moïse, the handpicked successor to President Michel Martelly, and Celestine, a former head of the state-owned construction company who was defeated by Martelly in the disputed 2010 presidential election. Russia submitted a revised draft resolution on coordination of efforts in the fight against terrorist organizations, particularly the Islamic State group, to the UN Security Council Wednesday. That, according to the country's permanent representative at the UN, Vitaly Churkin, speaking with the TASS news agency on Wednesday. Churkin noted that new provisions of the document had been inspired by a statement adopted at the G20 summit in Turkey's Antalya earlier this week, and confirmed that the document still includes a provision on coordination of any activities with governments of the countries where military operations are carried out. The previous draft resolution submitted by Russia in September was rejected by some members of the Security Council who are opposed to any cooperation with Syria's President Bashar al-Assad. That language, according to Churkin, quote, "has remained in the text," closed quote. Thousands of Hungarian nationalists gathered in Budapest Wednesday for an anti-migration and anti-EU demonstration organized by Jobbik, the Movement for a Better Hungary. Meanwhile, anti-refugee protesters also gathered in Poland's capital city, Warsaw, Wednesday in a protest organized by the nationalist All Polish Youth Group. Protesters chanted no to migrants and held signs saying immigration, Islam, the eradication of women's rights. Here in the U.S., as 31 out of 50 state governors say they want to stop Syrians from resettling in their states out of concern that terrorists may be hiding among them, one senior U.N. human rights official said that, although those fears may be understandable, they are, nevertheless, unfounded. André Michel Essangou, New York-based spokesperson for the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, told journalist Matthew Wells what does concern him about the fears being voiced by politicians inside the U.S.
What refugees and migrants expect and hope for and in fact deserve under international laws is assistance, is respect, and is certainly not to be discriminated against, because the assumption, if the views expressed by some politicians here and across Europe sometimes, is that the refugees and migrants are either criminals or are a fifth column of these terrorist organizations around the world, which really it's far from the truth for the vast majority of these people who indeed are running away from these very terrorists and criminals we're talking about, these people who have attacked in Paris, in Beirut, in Baghdad, and who in effect pushed millions of women, of men and children away from their home looking for help.
There does seem to be a genuine fear, though, here among the American population, that especially because this Syrian passport was found, which belonged ostensibly to a refugee, was found by one of the suicide bombers, that these concerns are real.
Yes, the High Commissioner has pointed out that in effect it's obvious and normal for people to be afraid for their security. It's understandable. One thing we must keep in mind, however, is that for the refugees and the migrants flying away from Syria or Iraq or Afghanistan, Eritrea and so many other countries, this fear is what they've lived with and what they're running away from, and that's the justification of them getting away of those countries, trying to get to safe havens.
These skeptical American politicians also say that they simply have no way of being sure that these people who are coming here, even if there are vetting procedures already in place, they just don't know who they are and why they're coming here.
From the evidence we have so far about the attackers in Paris, we're talking about potentially one person, and who was a refugee, and we're talking about hundreds of thousands of refugees who have come to Europe and other parts of the world. So, I mean, the confusion here is really more dangerous than anything else.
Former French Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin opposed the U.S. intervention in Iraq. He spoke with CCTV's Tian Wei about the best way to deal with ISIL and the fight against terrorism.
ISIS is mobilizing some young people. Some are coming from the immigrants, as you say, second, third generation, but some are not, are converted. People born in France from French families. So there is no laws in these matters. Mm-hmm. So we should be very careful in the way we are going to deal with that and not accept the way that ISIS is playing, the rhetoric of ISIS. We should be really, really firm on this. Our policies, and that's exactly what the French government is doing in trying to take some security measures in the framework of the state of emergency, but of course, respecting the state of law, respecting our traditions, respecting the framework of democracy.
On the other hand, why do you think, Mr. Prime Minister, there are so many young people, as you mentioned, whether they are the immigrants or they are from other ethnic groups, converted eventually to an extreme branch of Islam and subscribe to extremism? What are the root causes within your society that you think that are contributing to their motives toward this direction?
I think there's a wide range of motivations.
Like what? What do you think are the most important ones?
Social motivation, people that do have a sensibility that they should do something for the Syrian people and are mistaken and misunderstanding the reality of the situation in the Middle East. Some people motivated by religious, even if it is very often not the first factor. So there is a wide range of motivation, and ISIS is playing through the social networks, playing through a very strong communication is playing with these young people. But you should face and understand very clearly, this is not only a problem in France, this is a problem in Russia. You have many young Russian people or people coming from Caucasia that are attracted by this rhetoric. The same in Maghreb. You have 3,000 young Tunisians that are fighting in the ranks of ISIS. And you see in China how the Islamists are able to spread their ideology. So there is a strong capacity of this organization to convince young minds, which are weak minds, through wrong rhetorics. So we should be very careful. And that's why we need to understand these challenges, to propose different strategies. And in this regard, I think that the way China has been dealing with this fantastic project of the New Silk Road is a good way to put everybody around the table, all the countries of the region facing Islamist problems, facing terrorism problems, and giving them hope, more growth, more stability, less Islamism and terrorism. I think we need huge projects that make people having hope for tomorrow. Hope is an important key.
How can we provide people with hope or lead them with more hope? I mean, let's think about your society or some of the other European societies, for example, Belgium, for example, the Netherlands. Of course, there has been certain kinds of, as some say, historical guilt as a result of colonial history the European countries had in the Arab world. But then at the same time, when the immigrants are coming, some have been also talking about lack of sufficient policies to deal with their realities and their future, to provide exactly what you said as hope. But of course, all of these people that are on the blacklist or the people who committed the Paris attack, they are a very, very small minority of the Muslim community. They are the extremists, they are the terrorists. They're very different from the rest of the Muslim community. But it also brings an opportunity to do some soul searching about policies and also social securities, health, education, all of these issues related to that specific big community to do policymakers.
They are important keys, places where radicalization is very often made. School should be one very, very strong priority. We should be very careful what's happening at school, where we can see some young children that are more sensitive to these ideas, rejecting some approaches and being on the side. So school is certainly one of the important places where we can anticipate some of these risks. But there are others, prisons. Prisons are a place where very often radicalization through preachers, through different influences that can be found in prisons. So prisons is second place where we should be very careful. And there is a third one, which are radicalized mosques, where, of course, some extremist imams are playing a very negative role. So we should also be in a situation of closing these mosques, expulsing, having these imams out of France. So it's a huge variety of ways and means to deal with the issues. There's not just one solution, but many leverages that should be used. Of course, this implies a very strong surveillance, and we have been deciding to have much more people in our surveillance offices. This needs control and police operation. This needs more people,
intelligence,
in justice, in order to be able to deal with these problems.
Some suggest that the war in Iraq and some of the consequences of that might also have an impact on what happened today. Of course, others suggest that this is not directly from one leading to the other. Mr. Prime Minister, what do you make of these events? Are they really interlinked from your perspective?
In the last 15 years, starting with Afghanistan and of course Iraq, which has played an important role, but also a situation in Libya and in other countries, these military intervention, in many cases, they have contributed to a strong reaction coming from these Islamists. They have nurtured Islamism and terrorism. So we should be careful in the way of handling the military tool. Through the military, we cannot solve terrorism. And I do believe that the concept that George Bush put forward, war on terrorism, is not an efficient concept. We need to have a political strategy. Of course, the military tool can be helpful in very precise and limited cases, but it cannot be efficient if it is not included in a political strategy.
You were delivering a very well-known speech at the United Nations when you were the prime minister of your country, and you were against the war in Iraq. From what you just said, are you trying to readjust what you were trying to say before?
No, that's exactly in line with this. When I was Minister of Foreign Affairs of France in 2003, I just tried to explain to the international community that whenever we can avoid a military intervention, and at the time we could go in fighting against proliferation in Iraq without using the military, but using the inspection of the UN. When we can avoid that, it's always better. Mm-hmm. Because people always can react negatively to such military intervention. We had more than 100,000 people dying in Iraq. And of course, this creates more radical minds, more radical reactions. So we should be very careful in a very complex and sensitive region like the Middle East in the way we handle this. Mm. Whenever we strike in Syria, of course, there are some civilians which are hit. This creates motivation for young people to join the rank of terrorism. So military is not the only possible solution. It has to be used in a political framework, in a more strategic approach, which include social and economic approaches.
What are we seeing, Mr. Prime Minister? Is it a clash of civilization, as they suggest, the so-called Western civilization vis-a-vis the Islamic civilization? Or is it an inter-fight within the Islamic world itself about between extremists and also the rest of the community? What are we seeing?
You're absolutely right. It is, at the start, a strong rift between two parts of Islam, which is the Shia Islam and the Sunni Islam, and inside the Sunni world, an inner fight, of course, Daesh, ISIS, is from the Sunni world. So all these rifts, all these fights within Islam are creating the situation we know. But through military intervention, through wrong policies, we may put things worse. That's why we need two things that are really key at this very moment. First, we need the unity of the international community as well as of the regional community. We need to have everybody working in the same direction against terrorism, against Islamism. The second thing we need is to use the different tools in a very careful manner. Using the military whenever it's necessary, and it is necessary in some cases, but put the emphasis on the political solutions. We need to have it. We need a vision for Syria, for the future of Syria. We need a vision for the future of Iraq. We need to include all the communities and tribes. We need to have the Sunnis of Syria as well as the Sunnis of Iraq on board. We cannot have them on the side because they have been on the side, they have joined ISIS and supported ISIS. So as we see, it is complicated, it is difficult, but it is the challenge for the world today.
Well, I think that the key issue is whether Assad should go and when Assad should go.
Yes, I think it's not impossible to face to find an agreement. And I think that if we agree to discuss with everybody and have everybody around the table, of course, we should have the people that Assad do represent, the Alawites. They are part of the Syrian community. They are an important part. And, of course, the supporters of the Assad regime. But on the long run, which is the question, should we keep Assad or not? I think we should find a way to remove Assad. But in the meanwhile, to accept to have him being part of the solution. This is a difficult process, and I think Vienna really needs to tackle this important issue. Mm. But at this very moment, we should privilege, we should really put forward everything that can get us together.
All right.
Everything that can help us working together. This is the key. We need solutions, we need success. We cannot accept that ISIS plays with us, divides us, and pursue its goal, which is to create civil wars in many of our countries.
I see. What actually should France do next? What should the EU do next? Should the European countries close its border to the refugees and asylum seekers coming from Syria and Iraq? Should the European countries, especially within the EU bloc, get rid of the Schengen policies and many of the other interlinked policies which make this huge political experiment the most outstanding in the world? What should be done next?
I think it's very important to stick to our values and to stick to our principles. Democracy, the rules of the European Union, the Schengen rules, and of course, try to adapt what needs to be adapted. We need to control better our borders. That's why France has decided to take back the control of its borders for a period of time, which is allowed by the Berlin, the Dublin agreements. But of course, we need to adjust the European regulation. That's why France has been asking to have more efficient decisions to be taken in Brussels. So we must not, of course, close our borders to the refugees. This is not going to be the right answer. We need to do what we have to do concerning the right of asylum for the refugees. We need to be respectful of the people who are still hoping and putting a lot of hope in what Europe is. But at the same time, we need to give to our people, to the French people, to the European people, the security they need, that they ask and they deserve.
Are you too idealistic?
No, I think it is a question of balance. And if we are going to take the wrong decisions, these are going to be very wrong signals towards our population and outside, and this is going to fuel populism, and of course it's not going to be something good for Europe, neither for the world.
Over the past few days, Russia has stepped up its airstrikes on the Islamic State, now targeting the oil transport, which is the basis of much of the group's funding. On that, RT's Lizzie Phelan filed this report from Damascus.
The Russian General Staff has said that over the last 24 hours, they've struck 500 oil trucks transporting oil from Syria to refineries in Iraq, and that this has considerably cut down the militants' capability for illegally exporting oil and consequently getting revenues from the contraband, which is the single biggest source of funding for the Islamic State. Now, recently at the G20 summit in Turkey, we heard the Russian President Vladimir Putin say that the Islamic State is receiving financing from individuals from 40 countries, including G20 members, presumably from trade in oil. And he also revealed satellite images which showed convoys of Islamic State trucks transporting oil stretching dozens of kilometers, which Moscow has dubbed the Islamic State's pipeline on wheels. Now, shortly after those comments on Monday, the United States struck a convoy of 116 Islamic State trucks in Syria, which they appear to have been shamed into doing by President Putin's comments, because indeed it's the first time that they've targeted an Islamic State convoy of trucks transporting oil since they began their airstrikes against the group more than 1 year ago.
The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace and Reparations recently held a conference at Howard University. The chair of the group, Omali Yeshitila, spoke about various global developments, saying that the U.S. has funded every criminal with a gun and a bomb in the Middle East, and that the modern jihad that people are so upset about was created under President Carter's administration in the late 1970s.
Here you have the United States government that's given billions and billions of dollars to a white bandit entity that's called Israel, who has stolen the land of the Palestinians, set up a whole white nationalist settler state, claiming as their own, but that's all right. The United States can give it all kinds of resources, etc. The United States give resources to bandit governments and entities all around the world, but somehow Russia can't support an ally that's fighting what the United States claims is terrorism. Doesn't explain why the United States has been supporting these terrorists all this time and funded them and funded ISIS and funded every criminal with a gun and a bomb in the Middle East was funded by the United States. Even the modern jihad that people are talking about, they're so upset about, was created by the Carter regime and Brzezinski and rest of that. So all of this upset that they've got, you know, it portends like real serious contradictions. And Black people have to be aware of this. We have to be aware of what's happening. Did you know when the French fought in Vietnam to try to maintain Vietnamese colonialism, when they had to fight the Vietnamese, did you know that 71% of the people who fought in the French army against Vietnam were colonial subjects from Algeria, from Senegal, from all these other Black places? And I read during the 1960s that 65% of the people on the front lines fighting against the people in Vietnam were Black people from this country. Now, I'm telling you that what these guys are doing, they have serious implications for African people, so it's not something that we can ignore. And so that's why it's really important for us to have this discussion that we're having now. Because we don't just live in Washington, D.C. in Chocolate City or chocolate anything. Because you notice that what you call chocolate today, you know, tomorrow can be vanilla if they want it to be. So we have to understand what's happening in the world, and we have to understand where we fit in the context of a changing world that's got white power around the world trembling because they don't know exactly how to deal with it, because the traditional imperialist forces are having to fight to hold on to their world domination. And it doesn't mean that everybody they're fighting against is a friend of ours, but it does mean that imperialism cannot function in the same old way that it used to function in, and that we have a responsibility to understand where we as a people fit in this process to organize, build a revolutionary movement so that we can take advantage of the crisis of imperialism and win our freedom. I was there in August. In August, the Russians were responsible for, I say the Russians, formerly, is done by a group called the Anti-Globalization Movement of Russia. But there's no doubt about it that they are close to the Kremlin. They couldn't make stuff happen the way they do without being close to the Kremlin. So they sponsored this conference. It was a dialogue of nations and the struggle for self-determination. And invited there were Irish people, because as quiet as it's kept, there's people who are still in struggle with England, who kept Ireland under colonial domination for 800 years. The Irish were colonized for 800 years by the English. There were people there from Puerto Rico who were fighting for liberation. There were representatives from Hawaii, where the Queen was overthrown. And the Queen looked just like Sister Margaret here, right? Was overthrown in 1893. Overthrown by some white people just went there. Do you understand? It's a group of white people just went to this place called Hawaii, said, we want this. These are business, white business guys. Overthrew the Queen and took it over. And now it's now a part of what they call the United States of America. So there were representatives there, from there. There were representatives from Spain, from Catalonia in Spain, who have and created a massive movement. You're about to see Spain fracture. Because the majority of the people in what they call Catalonia want to be independent from Spain. So they were there. There were representatives from the Polisario Front who are engaged in struggle in the Western Sahara, where Spain had dominated them. And once Spain retreated, now Morocco has come in to keep the people from being independent. And these were some of the folk who were represented at that conference. There were people from Ukraine who even at this moment are engaged in armed struggle against this puppet regime that's been put in place again by the United States. So the discussion was a dialogue of nations, and everybody was there. This ain't like the United Nations where just anybody is there. Everybody who participated in this conference was trying to find a way to be self-determining. And I was there speaking for Africa and African people in that conference. That's what my role was with all of these forces there. And among the things that I put forward at the conference, and it was really interesting because nobody even challenged me on my right or authority or anything like that, because they know ain't no authority in Africa speaking for Africa or any other place. So we are the authority. And we are speaking for black people in this country too, and they're interested in what's happening to African people in this country because they see this incipient movement and they see the police murders and things like that. And I want to give them interpretation for it. Because if I don't give them interpretation for it, some white liberal or some other force will define this reality for us. So we put forth a working group. And out of this working group, we put the various kinds of demands that will become a document that's presented to the United Nations. And that we are going to get support from the Russians and from other forces because they got their own beef with the United States. So I don't know how much they like me. They act like they like me a lot. But the fact is, I know they got a beef with the United States. And I know that's the reason I'm there, because they got a beef with the United States. Well, I got a beef, too, with the United States. We got a beef, too, with the United States. I don't require them to like me or to love me. What I require of them is to show solidarity with the beef that I got so I can show solidarity with the beef that they got, with the enemy that both of us are able to recognize at this given moment.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.